Okay, it's 8:31. Let me begin. The date is the 20th, July 20th, 2020. As always, I want to respond just to some things from last class. I'm not going to be able to get to what I said I would, dealing with fast days or kashrus, and maybe next Shabbos. Next week I'll do that because I have a few things I want to do, and then we have a very exciting class, if I may say so myself. The first thing I want to mention is that we were speaking about at the beginning of last class the different gowns that people wear, graduation gowns. And George mentioned from Rabbi Mordechai Tendler that he thought it was a problem. Lo and behold, Rabbi Yonasan Rossman, he is the author of this book. It's called Tichat HaIgrot. Likutei Ha'arot al Sefer Igrot Moshe. It's a thick book. So over 700 pages. And he goes through much of the Igros Moshe, discussing the different criticisms of Ramosha. It's a unique book in that not only does it cite halakhic sources, it also cites academic sources. It cites the Sfarim blog. I can just open by random here. On page 448, he's citing Chalifut Mikhtavim being Professor Mark Shapiro, Rav Chaim Rappaport. So it's, if you're interested in the discussions of the Igros Moshe and how the later poskim have dealt with it, as well as how the later academic people dealt with it, this is a very important book. He's been listening to the classes. He's been listening for many years, actually. He emailed me to look in the Masoras Moshe, which I had totally forgotten about, two places. Well, first, the volume 2, page 196, and the exact same thing we heard from George. He says, and I'll just read you what he writes. He says, I spoke to Rav Moshe, my Rabbeinu, about doctors, and I, you know, they, when they finish, I don't know why I mentioned doctors, it's everyone, when they finish their studies, and they graduate, they wear the gowns that we all know. And he thought, shouldn't this be included as chukos agoyim? Because the original colleges were all theological institutions, and this is what the priests wore, and we all took it from them. And then he quotes Rav Moshe saying it's definitely forbidden. And then Rav Mordechai Tendler says, and don't say that the Jews would have come up on their own, because who would have come up on wearing a strange garment like this on their own? And Rav Moshe says, of course they wouldn't. And then Rav Moshe said, he wonders why Yeshiva University they do it, since it's obvious it's wrong. I have to say, I don't see why it's obvious it's wrong. According to the Vilna Gaon, it's wrong, but according to the Ma'arikin, the Rivash, it has a good reason. So Rav Moshe is saying it doesn't have a good reason. No one would wear this otherwise, but it does have a good reason. It's, the reason is that it's a sign of, like we said, the canner wearing it. It's a sign of, it's an indication that you've graduated. So for the Ma'arik, and this is the Shulchan Aruch's talk, you don't have to come up with it on your own. It's just that the reason you're wearing it is not related to idolatry. And just because and even the origin of it, the priests wore it, but there's nothing idolatrous. They didn't wear it for a mass or anything like that. They wore it as a sign of graduation. And let me show you now a couple pictures here. So you think it's not just YU, those liberals there. I can show you a picture of Dr. Belkin, etc. But you know who this is wearing a gown at Bar Ilan graduation? That's none other than Rabbi Grossman. He used to be known as the disco rabbi. So people, you know, you go into disco and get to for Bali Tshuva, but people don't realize he's actually a very big Talmud Chacham. And he's the Rav of Migdal Emek. And look who else is dressed. He kept his hat on, but Rev Shlomo Amar also at a Bar Ilan was given an honorary doctorate. So it's not just a YU sort of thing. As far as I know, Lander College, why you shouldn't say that? I don't know. Maybe Lander College doesn't. Someone from Toro used to, but I don't know Lander College, if they wear it or not. Maybe it's not a firm thing to do, I guess. It's like the rabbis. In the olden days, they would, but today they don't like to wear tuxedos for whatever reason. You go to a simcha, black tie, or all events, the rabbis, they're exempted. They don't have to wear tuxedos. So, but that's, you see that there's certainly what to rely on if you want to wear the gown. I guess if you don't want to wear the gown, Wayu's not going to say you have to wear the gown. And but then he pointed out also, Rabbi Rossman, which also I forgot, I can't remember everything. What can I tell you? A few pages before, on page 192, this whole section is dealing with Avodah Zarah. Mordechai Tenor asked him about the word saint. To say the word saint, Saint Vincent. I don't know where is Saint Vincent. It's a hospital. Yeah, that's what it is. But we have in New Jersey Saint Barnabas, and that saint is the same as San Francisco. Is it permissible? Because it refers to a holy Catholic saint. And Ramosha says, yes, there's no problem with that, because the word saint just means a holy person. It doesn't mean that you believe that this person's holy. It just means that this person is regarded as a special person. So you could say St. Thomas Aquinas Hall or something like that. Thank you, Rabbi Rossman. Right before the class started, Ruvain Buhana from Paris, who I think is on with us now, sent me something very interesting from Rav Yitzhak Yosef relating to last week's class. I was talking about how in the Sephardic world they didn't do Got. It was too expensive, despite the fact Shulchan Aruch, because they couldn't sell the non-Got. And this is a letter I could send to anyone interested from Rav Yitzhak Yosef to David Ibn Sur. What Rav Yitzhak Yosef said, that everyone has to keep Got. When I say Got, I mean Beit Yosef. No sirchut. That's what I said. You can't get really, except for in New York and Los Angeles, you don't really get it around. Otherwise, you won't get it. So you have to look into Toronto, where you can get Rabbi Kelman. You can get Beit Yosef in Toronto. You have a lot of. I don't know if you can. You might not be able to. So this man had written to him and said, "Wait a second. In Morocco, we don't. We eat regular kosher. We don't eat chalak." And Rav Yitzhak Yosef writes back to him and pay attention, because this I think is quite interesting. It goes against what I always assumed Rav Chacham Avadya Yosef held. He says that, thank you very much for your comment. He says, I'm speaking about Moroccans who came to Israel, that they are obligated to eat only Beit Yosef because they follow now the practices in the land of Israel. And he goes on and says it's vital to do this. But then he ends it. But he said, I'm not talking about the people in Morocco. Sham b'Morocco, yesh hakil hem hamshich b'min hagam akodem. You, Akadom, you said those people still living in Morocco, you should keep your old minhag of not having, of glot, because it says above in the question that this goes back even before the Shulchan Aruch. I don't know today if there's any glot in Morocco. You come on our tours. I can't say we're going to give you Beit Yosef. But from this letter, apparently there isn't. I asked the Shochet in Tunis. He comes from Djerba. In Djerba, they only use Beit Yosef. Tunis, they never used Got. I said, what do you do now? He says he tries to get Got if he can. When I say Got, again, it's Beit Yosef. Now, why is this letter of interest to me? Because if you read Chacham Avad Yosef's writings, he always says that Sfardim only need to eat Beit Yosef. That's the whole reason why in Brooklyn now there's Beit Yosef. The Syrians never ate Beit Yosef. They ate regular meat just like Ashkenazim. But due to the influence of Chacham Avad Yosef, who said again and again that Sfardim only have to eat Beit Yosef, they created a whole system of Beit Yosef, which I super got. And here you have, though, so the assumption of everyone is that Chacham Avad Yosef holds that all Sfardim need to do it. And here Rav Yitzhak Yosef is saying that, no, I'm not saying that the Moroccans have to eat Beit Yosef. When they come to Israel, they do, but when they're in Morocco, it's okay. They don't need to eat Beit Yosef. Maybe he's making a chiluk, a distinction between Moroccans, because they've been there now for all these hundreds of years and they've been eating it this way, whereas in America, they came from Aleppo, they came from here and there. There's no minhag, hamakom. I don't know, but this to me was quite enlightening, because we have Yitzhak Yosef saying that the Moroccans in Morocco do not need to follow the Shulchan Aruch and eat Beit Yosef meat. Okay, two more things. Someone emailed me, and I think we have with us, I mentioned we have a Dayan, we're fortunate, from Brooklyn, who's been listening to the classes, and I've discussed a number of things with him. One of you emailed me, we spoke last class about how much money you have to pay to save a person's life, and then we spoke about what you have to pay to avoid, let's say, eating non-kosher. Well, let me deal with this first. This wasn't a question, but and we said that the standard halacha is that you have to pay everything. That is, if you have a chance of eating regular food that's treif, or eating kosher food, If you look at the sources, they say you have to spend all your money on eating kosher food because that's actually kum. You're actually doing a maaseh. It's not what we say a shave. You're not doing anything, and someone dies. You don't have to spend all your money. The die-in feels as follows. What does that mean? You have to say spend all your money. Does that mean you have to sell your house? Does that mean you have to sell your furniture? What does that mean? You know, and we, in the olden days, people didn't have money like we do. We have pensions. We have money in, stock funds. We have property and all that. What, you have to sell all your holdings of all your stock holdings, all your property, so that to eat, so you won't eat treif if you have. I mean, what do we mean when people talk about it? Maybe in general, it's hard to know, but his feeling is that when they speak about all the money you have to spend, he thinks it means money laying around, not savings, or money dedicated to other things. That's with regard to mitzvah saseh. Sorry, mitzvah lo taseh, he did not say that. I don't know. He'll have to text in maybe perhaps what he says mitzvah saseh. The question was mitzvah saseh, where people say, for instance, you have to give a fifth of your money. That's in the Chayyad. That's elsewhere. What does that mean, you have a fifth of your money? If you're worth, $1 million, you have to give a fifth of your money? So the Dayan thinks that this is money laying around. Money you have. That's what people would have. Not that he said the post can never say to sell your furniture to do a mitzvah saseh or something like that. And then he pointed out something which I didn't know, and which he didn't know either until he investigated it, which I don't think anyone really knows. Rav Asher Weisstone is Minchas Asher on Moadim discusses a Simon Ches. Apparently this whole idea that you have to spend a fifth is a pretty recent idea on Mitzvah Seh. If you look in the Ramah doesn't say that. All the Ramah says is that don't spend more than a fifth on your money. And he relates it, he ties it into the idea that when you give tzedakah, this is in the Ramah in Orach Chaim, Tafresh Nun Vav Sifalef. He says, don't spend more than a fifth on your money on front of mitzvah. Just like in tzedakah, you're not supposed to spend more than a fifth. But Rav Asher Weiss shows that none of the Rishonim held this. It's true, the Chayyadim and some other Acharonim do say that you have to spend a fifth of your wealth for a mitzvah saseh. But none of the Rishonim say this. And it seems to be a myth that this is the standard halacha. The question, of course, is how much do you spend? And that's, he thinks that you'd spend whatever, you can't say, for instance, I'm not going to build a sukkah. If you need a sukkah, that's the mitzvah requires that. You don't need to build a very fancy sukkah. But there doesn't seem to be any actual rule as to how much you need to spend. So I thank you for that, our resident Don. Okay, the last thing I want to call your attention to, I hope you're sitting down because I think this is going to blow you away. It certainly blew me away. I've received a couple of questions or comments, I should say. People are shocked. They never would believe it, that they're actually poskim who say that you can donate money to help build a church, like we spoke about. I think we understand, it's not the normal thing. And this just proves the point that often things that we assume are far out crazy, maybe they're not. It just depends where you are. I'm going to show you something now, just because I'd seen it a few weeks ago when having this conversation with someone talking about, the Christianity, how can we relate like this? I think you'll enjoy this as well. We all know about interfaith relations, how Rabbi Soloveitchik really has set the model, so what you can and can't do. And the typical modern Orthodox rabbi who knows this, what does the Rav say in the famous article, Confrontation? You can speak with the other religions about matters of communal concern. You can speak about the environment, pollution, things that are concerned both of us, tax benefits, but you can't speak theology. And when the Rav said you can't speak theology, what he means, he doesn't mean in an academic sense. The Rav himself, the lonely man of faith, was delivered as a lecture at a Catholic seminary. He's not talking about having a conference, for instance, and talking about Jewish and Christian views about the Messiah. He's talking about an interfaith gathering where you're doing it for theological purposes. And the Rav was very concerned with the issue of quid pro quo, that we get together in a group like this and the Christians start making adjustments to their theology. They don't want to offend the Jews, so they take things out of the Easter Sunday, etc. And then they want us to make changes. He also develops the idea that when it comes to theology, each faith stands independent, and we can't really appreciate and understand what's going on in another faith, so we don't want to get involved in these interfaith discussions. Now, and that is pretty much held by the Orthodox rabbinate. There's been a few outliers, Yitz Greenberg, for instance, although there's a letter, it's been published on the internet, where the Rav writes to Yitz Greenberg saying that, I wouldn't do it, but if you're going to do it, I'm not going to criticize you. David Hartman was involved in interfaith. Michael Wishegrad, I don't know if anyone online with us knew Michael Wishegrad. It was amazing to me that Michael Wishegrad, you know, the way he would express his views against the Rav. I had a conversation with him once, but he had different positions on this. But when it comes to interfaith prayer, no one would ever do that. That's like the ultimate bad thing, interfaith prayer. You're going to tell me, so we get together in a room and we each say a prayer to God together. What's the problem? I'm praying to my God, they're praying. No, no interfaith prayer. That can't be done. Well, let me tell you that the chief rabbinate of Israel never accepted Rabbi Soloveitchik's views on interfaith gatherings. They've had interfaith where they discussed theology. It was at one of these groups with the scholars of India and the chief rabbinate that they came out with a statement that Hinduism is not a avodah zarah. So that's the first thing. So don't assume that what the Rav said has conquered the world. But I'm going to show you a video now. I hope you're sitting down, because I'm going to show you interfaith. What's the definition of interfaith? Interfaith is when Jews and Christians and Muslims are together and they're each praying together. They don't have to be reciting the same words, but they're reciting this their prayers together to God. I can't see how this doesn't fall under interfaith. That's the definition of interfaith, when Jews and Christians together come together to pray. And I want you to look at who is engaged in this interfaith prayer. It's not some left wing. It's not open Orthodox. It's one of the greatest poskim of our time. This is going to be more shocking to you, I think, than seeing Rav Shlomo Amar in a gown or donating to a church. So I got to give you sound. I can only imagine what the Rav, if he would have seen this, how he would be turning, his response to this. But this isn't Yitz Greenberg we're talking about here. Okay, here we go. Pay attention to who this is. Let me make my screen wide here so you can see it best.
Welcome to this historic event here in Jerusalem, where the religious leaders of this land, of this country, have come together for the first time ever to recite a joint prayer for divine mercy and compassion at this historic moment when we are challenged by a pandemic. We have here the chief rabbis of Israel, Rishon Lezion, Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef, chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi David Lau, Sheikh Akal Al-Atrash, and Sheikh Al-Obra from the Muslim community, the Patriarch Theophilus, the Orthodox Patriarch of Jerusalem, Archbishop Pier Battista Pizzaballa, the Apostolic Administrator of the Latin Church in the Holy Land, and Sheikh Hatem Halabi of the Druze community. Gentlemen.
God, the feast of the last, God of all creation, Lord of all generations, we arouse those who sleep and awakeness those who slumber. He heals the sick, open the eyes
of the blind. באים אנחנו לפניך בכפיפת ראש, בכפיפת קומה מתחננים. מאות אלפים מתו, מיליונים חלו. אנא אדוני הושיענה, אנא אדוני הושיענה. אנא אדוני הצליחנה, אנא אדוני הצליחנה. שלך רפואה שלמה לכל החולים, מנה מגפה מנחלתך. אנא אדוני אתה אשר ברעב זנתנו, ובסבא קלקלתנו, מדבר מילתתנו, ומחולאים רעים ורמים נאמנים דיליתנו. עדנה עזרונו רחמך, ולא עזבונו חסדך, על כן אנו מתחננים ומבקשים מלפניך, רפאנו ונרפא, הושיענו ונבשע כי תהילתנו אתה.
May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing before you, O Lord, my Rock and Redeemer.
שיר למעלות, אשא עיני אל הערים, מאין יבוא עזרי.
My hand comes from the Lord, maker of heaven and earth.
אל ייתן לנו את רגליך, אל ינום שומריך. הנה לא ינום ולא ישן שומר ישראל. אדוני שומריך, אדוני צילך.
Okay, is that the craziest thing you've ever seen? But that's interfaith prayer service for Corona. And I never could have imagined that I'd see one of the greatest post-schemers, Yitzhak Yosef, and the chief rabbi in Lau. I mean, if you told me it was Rabbi Sherwell or something, maybe. But these are in the heart of the Haredi community, and they're doing this. And this is exactly what the Rav said is absolutely forbidden. No question. But there it is. Okay, so now let's return to the Sefer. We're at Yoredeya Simon Nun. And this, the question is from Rav Herschel, it's to Rav Herschel Schachter. It takes us back a long time, 1985. I had this correspondence when I was in Israel in Yeshiva. In those days, we used to send the letters. Parents were always coming to visit. So our parents would send us to Israel with envelopes and American stamps. All you have to do is give it to someone, and their parents would bring it back, and they'd mail the letter. But the question is an interesting question, and someone raised this issue a few weeks ago. As I mentioned, I was interested in Ethiopian Jewry. So the issue which I had thought of was, well, are the Ethiopian Jews obligated in our practices? They're separated, assuming that they actually are an ancient community that predates the Talmudic period. There's debate, of course, on that. But going with that assumption, there were not there when all the Torah Shabbat was formulated and the rules were made. So are they obligated in Hanukkah? Are they obligated in Purim? Are they obligated in what the rabbis determine the halacha is? If the rabbis say you can't have chicken and milk, are they obligated in all these things? Or can they continue their minhagim? So let me read you Rav Schachter's answer and then tell you about a fascinating book that appeared. Maybe even someone for Torah in Motion to have speak. He speaks English quite well. Ethiopian Musmach of, I think he's a Musmach of Gush, actually. Rav Schachter answers me by pointing out that Bevadai, all Gezerot and Takanot fall upon the Ethiopians as well, or any Jewish community that was established before the Tkufa of the Mishnah and the Gemara. Why is that? Because that's, as he explains you there, the Sanhedrin established things, they bind everyone. Just because people didn't hear about it, didn't know about it. Kim Mitzion Teitzei Torah, you can't say that I don't hold to the Sanhedrin. They're not like Karaites. The Karaites, or the I should say Sadducees in ancient times, they rejected the rabbinic authorities. So fine, these people didn't reject the rabbinic authority. They didn't know about it, but they're still obligated on it. He goes into a discussion of the definition of what is considered the Posek Hador, Chochmei Hador, and then he says that not just the Hanukkah and Purim, which go back to the Sanhedrin, but also rabbinic laws, that were established before the closing of the Talmud, he says they're all obligated in it. And that's the standard rabbinic position. Other matters, he mentions that, later rulings, etc., they would not bind them. But Talmudic rulings would bind them. Okay, not a controversial ruling at all. Yet there's this Ethiopian rabbi named Sharon Shalom, and he published a book in 2012 called Misinai the Ethiopia. And this is a book of halacha for Ethiopian Jews. And it's not just this, he's a rabbi of a shul, also a shul of non-Ethiopians, just Ashkenazim. I think he studied in Gush. He's a musmach of the Rabbanut. The book presents a very different perspective than Rav Schachter. And if it was just this Rabbi Shalom writing it, you might say, big deal. It has haskamot from Rav Nachum Rabinovich, was passing a few weeks ago, was the leading authority in the elder authority in the religious Zionist world after Avraham Goldstein's passing. And Rav Shabtai HaKohen Rappaport. Rav Shabtai Rappaport is the grandson-in-law of Rav Moshe Feinstein, a real fine, excellent Talmud Chacham, as well as Haskama from Daniel Sperber. Okay, but he's, depending on your political leanings, whether you count him, but these are not outliers. And the whole point of his book, I'd be curious, I don't think Rav Shechter would give it Haskama. I know he wouldn't, for the simple reason that Rabbi Shalom takes into account the fact that it's not easy for the Ethiopian Jews to entirely reject their traditions to become modern rabbinic Jews. As such, the book goes through all sorts of areas where the Ethiopian halakha, if you want to put halakha in quotes, you can put it in quotes, differs from mainstream, you know, rabbinic halakha. And he tries to, in some cases, say you have to reject the Ethiopian practice. Others, he thinks you can keep it. And so, for instance, he rules. Now, I don't know if Rabbi Rabinovich accepts this ruling. It's hard to know with Haskamot whether it means you accept everything in it or whether he sees it as legitimate, but listen to what he says. He thinks, for instance, that the older generation, when they were in Ethiopia on Shabbos, they didn't have the concept of mukzah. So they would carry money to shul on Shabbos and they would give tzedakah. That's an important part of their Shabbos ritual observance, is giving tzedakah. Well, you can't get tzedakah, it's mukzah, but it's rabbinic. It's not Torah. So he rules, halacha l'maisa, that for the older people who are not being educated in the modern Israeli school system, they can bring money to shul on Shabbos to give tzedakah. So here you have a ruling by an Orthodox rabbi, a musmach of the chief rabbinate, Haskamot on his sefer, in which he rules, halacha l'maisa, that we don't need to tell the older Ethiopians that they need to stop this practice. They grew up with this, and it's okay because they are preserving a pre-rabbinic practice, and they preserved it for thousands of years. They can preserve it for one more generation because this is just a one generation or two generation thing, because the younger people were all being educated in regular schools. When the book came out, a group of Ethiopian rabbis who were educated in the Shas school system, They dress in black and they look like Yemenites, but they're proteges of Rav Avad Yosef school system. They came out and condemned this book as anti-halachic. And in a sense, it is anti-halachic because he's saying that certain people don't need to keep the halacha, but not because he rejects halacha. He's arguing that, and as I said, it has a haskama. If this is a treif book, a pasul book, you wouldn't have the haskama of Nachum Rabinovich. Even if Nachum Rabinovich doesn't agree with every point, he thinks it's a kosher book. And Rav Shabtai HaKohen Rappaport, in which he's saying that for the older generation, they don't need to immediately be bound by various rabbinic prohibitions. So it's an amazing approach, interesting way of looking at it. He was on, some of you might listen to David Lichtenstein's show. He was on David Lichtenstein's show about a year ago. Unfortunately, David Lichtenstein, or maybe fortunately, didn't really know what he's all about, what the book's all about. He just asked some general questions, and he didn't really catch it when Rabbi Shalom made a few comments. I can only imagine what David Lichtenstein would have asked him had he known what the book really said. He just was asking him general questions about an Ethiopian rabbi deciding halacha, but what type of halacha is he deciding? So this is in opposition to Rav Shechter. Okay. Now we move on to a very interesting and important responsa. I think it's the most quoted of all the responsa of Rav Yehuda Ratzel Henke. This is Yoredeya number 51. And until the book appeared, no one knew who was written to, which maybe was good. But before I do this, I need to give some background. The title of the tshuva is Talmid Chacham Shehifkir Be'acherim Ha'im Tzrichim Chabdo. If you have a Torah scholar who degrades others' Torah scholars, do you need to respect him? What am I talking about here? I want to show you something. The Mishnah Torah says, Hilchos Talmud Torah, chapter 6, Yud, this is the Kafach version, so it depends on which, and the regular, I don't know which is the regular numbers, but Yud Aleph and Yud Beis. It says it's a great sin to degrade the sages, and this is Halacha Yud Aleph. It talks about how terrible it is. And then it says in Yud Beis, one who degrades the sages, Ein lo cheil kolam haba, and you have to put him in cheirub. So we have the ruling of the Rambam, which is found in the Gemara. It's not the Rambam is just taking it from the Gemara, that one of the definitions of an apikoros, and an apikoros is no share in the world to come, is if you degrade your mavazet, Torah scholars. Well, we have a problem here, because throughout Jewish history, many great rabbis have degraded other rabbis in their disputes, and they think they're justified in degrading them, because they think the other rabbi is doing evil things. But what are you supposed to do if another great rabbi degrades your rabbi? Are you supposed to degrade him in return? How are you supposed to relate to him? The question, the reason I asked the question was because I started reading the literature of the Satmar Rebbe. And the Satmar Rebbe has all sorts of extreme statements. Anyone who accepts the state of Israel, it's they're a worshiper of Avodah Zarah. Now, subsequently, and I mentioned this in a note, I concluded, and Satmar people have told me I'm right, that you have to distinguish in the Satmar Rebbe between rhetoric and his real feelings. So when the Satmar Rebbe says that anyone who accepts the state of Israel is an idol, is worshiping Avodah Zarah, that's an element of rhetoric. He doesn't mean that you're literally an idolater and a heretic. Because if so, you'd have a problem. How does he respect Rav Aaron Cutler, which he clearly did? Rav Aaron Cutler accepted the state of Israel and argued in favor of being in the Knesset. So there's an element of rhetoric here. However, there are times when the Satmar Rebbe, so for instance, with Rav Kook, Satmar Rebbe calls him a heretic, a complete heretic. And it's not only the Satmar Rebbe, there's others as well. So how are you supposed to relate to a Torah sage who refers to one of your great sages as a heretic? So it's a very interesting question. Before we see the sources, let me just mention a few more points. I thought I knew what the answer was going to be. It turns out I was incorrect. I realize we can't go about practically degrading other sages, because then we'll the whole world's going to be degrading each other. But what about the halacha? In general, we assume we respect everyone. Even the Aguda assumes this, which itself is fascinating, because here you have Rav Chaim Kanievsky, who says about Rav Shmuel Auerbach that he's a Zakei Mamre, and he doesn't deserve respect. But in America, for instance, the Aguda's attitude is always, and they've always said this, that we don't get involved in Machlokas, we respect all the great rabbis. But that's interesting for the purpose that Rav Chaim Kanievsky says you're not supposed to respect all the rabbis. You're not supposed to respect that one. And therefore, the Aguda's in a bit of a bind here, because Rav Chaim Kanievsky is telling him not to respect the other one. So they're really not respecting Rav Chaim Kanievsky's wishes. So, but the decision's been made in many cases, not just this one, that the masses shouldn't get involved in these disputes. The masses should respect all the rabbis, even though the rabbis on this side and that side tell you, no, don't respect the other one. So it's really not listening to Das Torah. Now, my first discussion on this matter before... Well, this is from 1990, it was around the same time, was with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was spending time in Newton at his son-in-law, Rabbi Siegel, the rabbi of Bethel in Newton. So I went to see him, and I had a number of questions to ask him. But one of the questions I asked him, I was curious about this. I just wanted to hear how his perspective, what do? Just say, we don't follow the Gemara, we don't follow the Rambam. And I knew that he was a big fan of Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was a big fan of Lubavitcher Rebbe. There were many in the Litvisher world. Rav Moshe Feinstein was a big fan of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Litvisher world was split between fans and opponents. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said that, his son quotes him as saying this, from Nelson Kamenetsky, that had Rav Moshe gone to a Musar yeshiva, he wouldn't have felt this way about Lubavitch. But okay, the Litvish world was split on this. Actually, as soon as Rav Steinman took over the Haredi world, all of a sudden the battle against Lubavitch was finished, and there's peace. And the current Satmar Rebbes have no issue with Lubavitch. They go to Chabad houses, they eat there, etc. So I asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, what are we supposed to do with Rav Shach? Shach is saying terrible things about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rambam says if you degrade a Torah sage, you have to be put in Chayrim. So I asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, so do you think that we should put Rav Shach in Chayrim? I knew he was going to say, I mean, what, I don't mean it as a chutzpah question. It's, I don't have a dog in this race. But I just wanted to know from a pure Brisker standpoint, someone who greatly respected the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and here you have another Torah sage degrading him, saying terrible things about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, what Rav Aaron would say, because the Rambam says you have to put him in Chayrim. And Rav Aaron said to me, he says, today we can't enforce this. Today we can't. Just says we can't. And I understand, obviously you can't. What are you going to do? You're going to go back, you're going to, the Yaakov Emdin, you're going to put him in Chayrim, and then you're going to put his followers, are going to put Rav Yehoshua and Ibshitz in Chayrim. The whole thing, we'd have the Chayrus all over the place. So Rav Aaron said to me that today we cannot, you know, that it, basically it's not actionable. And that we, she said, we should just sit on the side. If they want to fight, they can fight, but we don't get involved with this. Then I asked, and that's the standard view, except when people don't want it to be the standard view. Whenever people want to come out and condemn someone for disrespect to a gadol, they pull out that Rambam and say, this person will not be cursed, with no share in the world to come. But it's used only in certain times when they don't like what's said. It's not you in a particular case. It's not used elsewhere. Incidentally, I think that this idea that you have to respect all the gadolim, even if you don't, we're going to see Rav Avinir says that. I don't know if that applies if they came after you yourself. So for instance, Nassim Slifkin, he was put in Chayrim by these people. Or his book was put in Chayrim, and he was called a heretic. Does he still, if you're being called a heretic, do you still need to respect these rabbis? I can tell you from personal conversations, Rav Nosson Kamenetsky felt no. Rav Yoshev, he kept on a pedestal, and he continued to respect him. But the other ones, why, he did not show any respect to them. And why should he? They said he's a heretic, and they said, one of them said he's a heretic because he was a Vaza, but they said his book is degrading of the Gedolim, et cetera, et cetera. So that's an interesting question. But then getting back to Rav Aaron, I asked him, I said, what about Rav Moshe Stern? Moshe Stern was the Debrett Senior Rav. That's what he was known by. He wrote six volumes of Chuvas Ber Moshe. He was a Rav of a Hungarian, Ashkenazic Hungarian, non-Hasidic Hungarian shul. Although the Hasidim sort of liked him also, he got involved with Satmar. He said some terrible things about Rabbi Soloveitchik.
You can see them in, you want to see an English translation,
in Lamb's book, Torah Mada, pages 52 to 53. He quotes how that it's not permissible to teach in YU. Since a rabbi who's great in Torah stands at the head of it, people think he's great in Torah, but in truth, he's blasphemous and abominable. So here Moshe Stern is saying terrible things about the Rav. So I asked then, what about, would you say the same thing about Rav Moshe Stern? Could we quote him? And he says, no, no. And then all of a sudden, I think he saw his family ties. He said, you should not quote Rav Moshe Stern. When I was in Central Europe last year, some of you listening were with us. So do you remember who we met in Budapest? Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron's son. I saw him there. I had never met him before, but I recognized him. I spoke to him Shabbos morning and Shabbos afternoon between Mincha Ma'ariv. He gave a little talk to our group while we were waiting between Mincha Ma'ariv. But I told him all the things I spoke to his father about, and I told him this about the Debrett Senior, and he said, my father told me a long time ago not to trust him. Debrett Senior, not to follow his psalm, but not because of what he said about the Rav. He gave me some other tshuva where the Debrett Senior says something crazy about non-Jews, which he thought was immoral. And that's why Rav Aaron said, don't ever quote the Debrett Senior. Okay, so getting to the question of, that was my question. How are we as religious Zionist Jews supposed to relate to the Satmar Rebbe? Are we supposed to respect him? Are we supposed to give him all the fancy titles, call him Zatzal and everything? Because he is degrading rabbis, certainly Rav Kook, and other religious Zionist rabbis as well. But you can take it, it's not really important who the question is about. It's the issue of what do you do with rabbis and degrade others. And in the note, I explained, as I mentioned already, that subsequently I learned that it's really rhetoric a lot of this. But it is true that Rav Kook, he calls him a heretic. So what to do? So Rabbi Henkin, and his view is going to be different than Rabbi Avinir, which is, we'll see, is really, I think, noteworthy. He really spends a good deal of time on do you have to refer to someone as a Gaon, as Zechar Tzadik Livracha, that sort of thing. That really wasn't my issue per se. There's a lot of good Torah study here, but that doesn't really interest me so much. On page 120, he says that after going through, you know, the last four pages, you don't have to, in general, there's no rule. You don't need to call someone Zatzal. The question was, could we say Zecher Tzadik Livracha? Maybe he's not a Tzadik. If he attacked Rav Kook that way, maybe he's not a Tzadik. Maybe, I don't know, I'm asking. And he says, in general, there's no rule that you have to say this. If he's not your Rebbe, you don't need to give titles. And then he says, well, what you ask, do you have to respect him at all? Because I asked the question as well. Do we need to respect someone who thinks that our way of life is terrible and all these things and it degrades our rabbis? Now, Satmar's, I'll tell you something about Satmar. I know we have, I think we have one person right now from Satmar listening. They know, in effect, I'm sort of honorary Satmar even. I've been invited to be with them in a few places at times. I have no problem with Satmar per se. Even their idea, their anti-Zionism, that doesn't bother me. If they want to be anti-Zionist, they could be anti-Zionist. It never really concerned me. What always concerned me about Satmar was the fact that the degrading of Torah sages that disagree with them. Today, I think I would take that back a little because Satmar is now giving cover to BDS. Even Ilhan Omar, I think it was Omar, not Talib, said that some Jewish theologians agree with her, meaning like Satmar. So now it's very hard to fight BDS, anti-Semitism, BDS, because they say, well, you have this large, the largest Hasidic group in the world. And they're not just anti-Zionist, Satmar. At their rallies, they are BDS. They talk about how the state, they talk about the Zionists controlling the world. They use anti-Semitism. They give all the propaganda points of BDS. So now we have a problem because Satmar is, even without wanting to be per se, because they have no interest in BDS as a movement, but they are providing cover for BDS. And that, so in a sense, it makes them, as a movement, it makes them quite dangerous in the ways that they weren't even 10 years ago. So I think that it's important that we be very opposed to the movement of Satmar in terms of their anti-Zionism. While the people, many of them are wonderful, but it's a very negative force. I showed a couple semesters ago that the chinuch they offer, you can find it online very easily. They brought a car in, and they told the kids, and these are 8-9-year-old kids in camp, that the Netanyahu's in the car, and they all had eggs, and they throw it at there. I mean, this is terrible. This is like the anti-Semites do. So we have to hold them to that. Now, so the question, though, what do we have to respect him? And he says, who am I to answer a question like that? But then he quotes his grandfather as saying something significant. He says, my grandfather, this is on page 121, said about the Satmar Rebbe that if he lived in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, he would be regarded as a Zakein Mamre. Because the rest of the sages say one thing, and the Satmar Rebbe goes against them. Satmar Rebbe always said that it doesn't matter what the others say. If I'm right, I'm in the majority. He says, they didn't care. You think Satmar cares about the Aguda? They don't consider them. They don't take orders from them. And Rabbi Henkin continues, Rabbi Yehuda Rotzek, this is not about his sitkus. He could be a very great tzaddik. And the Zakein Mamre was also, could be a Gaon and a tzaddik. After all, he has to be a Chacham, Sheigil Hora. He has to be a great Talmud Chacham. But if he doesn't follow the majority rule, he's a Zakein Mamre. And therefore, he says, my grandfather said that this Otzel Gadol, that's the way that Rabbi Henkin put it, he didn't want to mention him by name, that he's cholik on the entire world. If this was the time of the Beis HaMikdash, he'd be a Zakein Mamre. And then he goes on, but what he's, Hifkir Barova Olam, what he basically degrades most of the world, including great Torah sages, he says that's in accordance with his view, that he didn't follow what others say. And it didn't matter to him that great Gedolim, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, etc., admired Rav Kook. He did his own thing. And then Rav Henkin asks the question. He says, but even according to the Satmar Rebbe, fine, Rav Kook is wrong on this one matter. Why does it make him a heretic? Rav Hillel in the Gemara, he's quoted as saying that Mashiach, there's no such thing as Mashiach because it already came in the days of Chizkiyahu. And although they rebuke him for that, they don't regard him as a heretic. difference is obvious, that the Satmar Rebbe didn't think Rav Kook was just wrong on one thing. He thought his whole, everything was wrong. And in the note, Rav Henkin says, in general, as a rule, if you see a great Talmid Chacham who seems to say something heretical, don't push him away. Don't regard him as a heretic. Reject that one area, but it doesn't mean that you can toss him out, because, and he brings a proof that the Ritva, the Rambam has this position at Asmachta. You sometimes have drashot in the Gemara, and the Rambam doesn't think, and if you read the Gemara, just on the face of it, the simple shot is that the drasha, the exegesis, creates the halacha. That's what creates the halacha. The Rambam doesn't accept this. He says, no, this is an oral tradition. The drasha is just sort of something like to put a peg onto it. He calls it a smachta. The Ritva says that this is it's a view of minos. It's heresy. It's basically taking the whole Gemara, all the drashas, and throwing it out. And but Rabbi Henkin said he obviously didn't consider the Rambam a heretic, but you can say a view is a heretical view. It doesn't make you think your person's a heretic. The Ramban says about the Rambam's view that certain events happen in dreams, like the story of Abraham and the angels. He says that's a heretical position. But the person's not a heretic. You can have what they think is a heretical view, and they recognize that you don't think it's a heretical view. So I can think it's a heretical view. You're a Bar Hachi, you don't think it's a heretical view. It's no different than any other machlokas. I could say that Bishul, there's a big machlokas, what's Bishul? How much does it have to be? So I think Rav Aaron Cutler held 122 or 123 degrees makes it Bishul. I think Rav Moshe's position is 114 degrees. So does Rav Moshe think that Rav Aaron Cutler is a Machal Shabbos? No, for Rav Moshe, 123 degrees or 122, that would be 120 degrees, you're Machal Shabbos. Does he think now, because Rav Aaron is doing it at 120 degrees, he's heating up water 120, he's Machal Shabbos? No, because Rav Aaron is able to make his own decision. And that's the way halacha obviously works. He goes on, and he throws in something interesting also about that putting people in chayrim, sages. We're not supposed to put a Torah scholar in chayrim. The Rambam says you put them in chayrim, but you're also, we have sources, you're supposed to slow down. Don't do it too quickly. Because it's a chil Hashem if we do something to Torah sages. And then he concludes the last paragraph that the important thing is not to cause chil Hashem. He said we have a problem here because even though he's deceased now, his students learn from his things and they learn to be mevaze, great Torah scholars. I'm going to do a Sfarim blog post, not my next one, the one after it. I'm going to give you some examples of what the Satmar people were saying about Roy Steinman. I mean, the most unbelievably terrible things. So can you blame the Satmar Rebbe? He's not alive now, but he taught this lesson, basically, that certain people go over the line and you can just treat them. They're not considered reliable rabbis, and that who knows where that will lead to. So he says, therefore, whenever there's a Chol Hashem, he says, we don't give kavod. So he says, don't bless him, don't curse him. In other words, mind your business. You don't. We don't need to go degrading the Satmar Rebbe and saying terrible things. On the other hand, we don't need to build him up. If you look in the Aguda newspapers, the Satmar was so opposed to Agudas Yisrael, and yet if you read the Agudas newspapers, they treat him like he's the Gadol Hador, even though he was the biggest opponent of Agudas Yisrael. Because on the right, it's always easy to respect people on the right. Even if they reject your lifestyle entirely, it's there's something about on the right that you can't do it with people on the left. The Agudas can't do it to Rabbi Soloveitchik, but they can do it to someone on the right because people have this sense that they're holy. That's just a phenomenon that exists. People are always giving tzedakah to institutions on their right. They're never giving tzedakahs to institutions on their left. Why not? Why can't you say, well, I don't hold of all the hashkafas, but I see that is doing a valuable thing, that institution. Life doesn't seem to work like that. So Rav Henkin says basically, and he says that we should be, this is the famous expression, the Rambam, we should be now loving, v'lomim ovim. We should be, if they want to make fun of us and mock us and criticize our rabbis, fine. We don't need to respond in kind. We don't need to get in the gutter with them. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was well known, unlike Rabbi Tendler, Moshe Tendler, who knows how to slug it out. And whenever they would say things, he would get into the gutter with them and slug it with them because he thought that this is required based on Torah. After the Jewish Observer did their phony eulogy on the Rebbe Soloveitchik. Rabbi Tengler let him have it, and he's done that, and he believes that this is, you have, need to stand up for Torah. Rabbi Lichtenstein's approach always was that we do our thing, and we and that was Rav Kook's approach also. We don't respond. We don't respond. Rav Kook said, Ma'at or docha harbe choshech. A little bit of light will clear out a lot of darkness. We do our thing. Let them attack us. Let them do things. I think it's a personality thing. Rav Tengler's personality is like a vibrant type of explosive personality that he's not going to stand for. He thinks is nonsense. Therefore, during the whole Mitzitza thing, it was him who got up publicly and went to the, you know, even the authorities and said, you have to stop this Mitzitza. It's going to kill babies. So that's his personality. And Rabbi Lichtenstein's attitude was, you know, we'll let them mock us. We don't need to respond. Really, Rabbi Tengler's position is in line with the Rambam, apparently, that you're supposed to, these people are supposed to be put in their place. And it says in the Gemara in Tainis, I think it's Daf Zayin, that the insolent ones, we have to call them a Russia, because they're insolent. And but as Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik says, that halacha l'maisa, it's hard to do this today. So that's how Rabbi Hinken ends. But I now want to tell you about Rabbi Avinger. You would think that Rabbi Avinger, who's Rabbi Avinger? Rav Henkin has nothing to do with Cook. Rav Henkin's a Talmud Chacham from America. But here is Rabbi Avinger. Rabbi Shlomo Avinger is from the Talmud Mufak of Ratzvi Yehuda Cook. He's one of the leaders in the Kav, that group of religious, the Haredal movement, who are what I call the Kav. And he is an enormously prolific author, probably writes 10, 15 books a year. I don't know how he does it. It's like Jacob Neusner. He might be the most widely published halachic author in history, Rabbi Avinger. And he's at the yeshiva. They used to call it a Teret Kohanim. Now it's a Teret Yerushalayim, and a big expounder of Rav Kook. Almost all of Rav Kook's writings, he's reissued them with his commentary. He's on halacha. Fascinating individual. He was one of the first to start doing these SMS tshuvot, where you just ask questions and he answers them. So I wrote to him as well with the very same question, and this is Siman Nun Bet. And because he's such a Cookian from that school of Rav Kook, his answer is very different than Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, is noteworthy. The question is, you have a rabbi who's mevaza, he degrades Zionist rabbis in front of his students, and there's no way to stop him. Can you respond in kind to him? Because he's doing a chil Hashem. So he says, first of all, it's forbidden to listen to a rabbi say things like that. You can't listen to a rabbi degrade another rabbi. And you have to protest with all your strength. Because also a Talmud Chacham has to respect other Talmidei Chachamim. And there's no heter to degrade them because of their views behilchot Sibur. The word Hilchot Sibur is a, I'm going to show you in a little bit from Ratzvi Yehuda Cook. Here it's called Hilchot Sibur. That this is a phrase from the Merkaz world, Hilchot Sibur. The halachas of the Tzibur, as far as I know, no one ever used it before Ratzvi Yehuda Cook in the way he uses it. So Hilchot Sibur, religious politics. So you have to... there's no heter to degrade another rabbi because they have a different view on Zionism or any of these things. If he's a Talmid Chacham, you have to respect him. There, so he says, like, you can't degrade a rabbi because he's a Zionist. And then he says, there's an Isser Chamur, a strong Isser, to degrade any rabbi from any circle, from any shita, and it's also a strong Isser to listen to a degrading of a Talmid Chacham without protesting. So he says we cannot listen to any rabbis being degraded. And if you're in an area, if you're listening to a shiur, and the rabbi starts saying negative things, like let's say he starts referring to JB, and saying bad things about Rabbi Soloveitchik, you're obligated, which I don't think would happen today. This isn't 50 years ago. Today, I don't think they would do that. But if you would hear something like this, you're obligated to protest. What does protest mean? It means you could call out and say what you're saying is wrong. Maybe it just means get up in a demonstrative way and saying I'm leaving because I can't sit and listen to someone who degrades Gedolim, whatever it means. And he says there's no contradiction between these two things. Because on the one hand, you have to respect Torah sages. Even this Torah sage who's degrading another Torah sage, you still have to respect him. But there's also Tochacha. there's a commandment of rebuke, and you even have to rebuke a great Torah sage. And if a great Torah sage refuses to take rebuke, then that's a negative sign on him, because it shows that he's not willing to listen. Then he gets it. And then I replied, and I'm going to end with my question, because we'll pick up next week on the answer. I write back to Rav Avner, and I said, I'm still confused. Because how can you respect people, even Talmidei Chachamim, who are degrading great Torah scholars? How can you respect them? I say it's known that there are Talmidei Chachamim, many, who degraded Rav Kook, and that's part of the problem. The Rugachever degraded Rav Kook. There's a number of Gedolim who said terrible things about Rav Kook. You could say, well, if they knew Rav Kook, maybe they wouldn't have said it, but they did say it, the Munkacher. So I understand. You really can't say that we're going to reject all of them, because then you're really rejecting some important scholars. But I want an answer. How do we understand this? I say it's known that there are Talmidei Chachamim who degraded Rav Kook. And then I say, look in this book, Lehilchot Tzibur, page 118. And I'm going to tell you about the amazing case. Those who are with me with their Rav Yisrael Meltzer classes might remember it, but the case in Jerusalem where they put Rav Kook on trial, these young Agudas Yisrael people, they sentenced him as an idolater and they killed him, in quotes. It was all part of a Purim spiel and the implications of this and what this led to, because you know, Rav Avner is saying that you have to respect all Torah scholars and even if they make errors. What about the fact that there's this one individual, until at the end of his life in the Merkaz world, he was regarded as Mechutz Lamachana and an Apikoros because of what he did to Rav Kook? How does this square with what Rav Avner is telling me? And then I say, certainly Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, that's his Rebbe, Rav Kook's son, did not respect the heads of Neturei Karta and Satmar, who degraded his father and other Gedol Yisrael. Wait till you hear what Rav Avner says about Rav Tzvi Yehuda and Satmar, that he did respect them, and even was invited to a wedding. Things, it blew my mind to hear this. But we're going to do this next class. We're going to pick up with the answer of Rav Avner, and then I'll tell you a bit about the history of the old Yishuv and the famous case of putting Rav Kook on trial and what that led to. Agudas Yisrael. If any of you are Agudistan, you need to know this, because Agudas Yisrael, there's really two parts to Agudas Yisrael. The Jerusalem Agudas Yisrael was a terrible thing. It was a terrible institution, the Jerusalem Agudas Yisrael. It got to be so bad that that's what led to the break, and the Polish Agudas Yisrael couldn't take it anymore. The things that the Agudas Yisrael, it was like the Neturei Karta. And it's important for people on Agudas Yisrael to know this, that their history is not so pure. And that they were reluctant to break with the Jerusalem branch because they thought it would create certain problems. Eventually, the break was inevitable because the way they started treating the Ger Rebbe, who was the most important figure in Agudas Yisrael. But Agudas Yisrael is complicated because it had a normal branch in Europe, Germany, Poland, and then it had the branch in Jerusalem, which was basically controlled by super extremists, people like Dahan. If you know who Dahan was, I'll tell you about him next class. Not to say that it was correct for the Haganah for the Zionists to assassinate Dahan, but if you know what Dahan was doing, you're dealing with a problematic figure. I'll get to that in the next class. And then we're going to move on. We'll get more from Rav Schechter, some interesting things he says about Mitzitza, and then we'll get to a letter from Chaim Amsalam, which will get us into a great discussion. Title of it is Giyur Lo Kiyum Mitzvot, conversion without accepting mitzvot. What does that mean to accepting mitzvot? Everyone knows you need to accept mitzvot when you convert, but what does it mean to accept mitzvot? If I convert and I tell Lashon Hara, that means the conversion is not valid. What does that mean? What have rabbis in the past understood it to mean? The fact that we've had this big issue the last 20 years shows that something has changed in the last 20 years. And this is from Rabbi Chaim Amsalam. Chaim Amsalam, whose departure from Shas, actually he was thrown out of Shas, created a political earthquake about 5 years ago. It's no accident that he's a Talmud Muvhak of Rav Mazuz. The problem with these people like Rav Mazuz is they teach their students to think independently. Well, if you teach them to think independently, you end up with people like Rav Amsalam, and since he's been thrown out of Shas, he's gone even further to the left, I think you can say, and come up with all sorts of interesting things. But he is an enormous Talmud Chacham, and he's a posek. And it's an unusual case of someone in his late 50s who adopts a completely different worldview. So I'll tell you, I met him for the first, actually second time, but I had a long conversation with him. I had spoken to him briefly earlier, but I was at the Sheraton. The Sheraton around the corner from the Inbal, having Shabbos lunch, and who walks in because his family's there? None other than Rabbi Chaim Amsalam. So unfortunately, he doesn't speak any English. So otherwise, I'd recommend him giving a little talk on Torah notion. He just knows. So I'll talk about him, and we'll get into this important issue of conversion, which affects all of us. So it's already 9:30, 31. So let me go back and I'm sorry. I know Nachum Shmaryahu, thank you for sending me. I'll say it quickly. Nachum Shmaryahu, he sent me the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe deals with Shituf. I don't know what to make of it. We have some Chabadniks listening to us. In some places, the Rebbe says that non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf, and their Christianity is a kosher religion for non-Jews. In other places, he says that it's not. It's just plain Avodah Zarah. I'm thinking that perhaps he distinguishes in America, he was very reluctant to give things about prayer in school because recognizing Christianity is legitimate for non-Jews, because I think maybe Jews could be influenced, and it's Avodah Zarah for Jews. Maybe the Rebbe didn't care if it's in Ecuador or something like that, but I don't know. It seems to be a steer. So thank you. I don't know if you're with us now, Nachum. And the others who emailed me can't get to everything. Baruch says, Rabbi Grossman is a big Talmud Chacham. Please elaborate. Has he written any Sfarim? He's written articles. He hasn't written Sfarim. I'm told he's a big Talmud Chacham. If he's not, then I stand corrected. But I'm told that his father was, without question, a very big Talmud Chacham, and I'm told that he is. I met him in Long Island about 15 years ago. He used to give hashgacha on marshmallows with the old gelatin, not the new Granny's marshmallows. I think it was them when they used to have real gelatin. He gave the hashgacha. He was very close to Rav Avad Yosef. I don't know why he was close to Rav Avad Yosef, but he was. Chaim tells us that at least 10 years ago, when his daughter graduated, all the faculty and students at Torah wore gowns. I knew they wore gowns. I said that. I want to know whether they wear it at Lander College, because you have Torah and then you have Lander College. I'm certain the rabbis don't wear it at Lander, but if you could tell me if Lander College wears it, I see two wows. I think those wows are about the interfaith prayer. And I know, Barry, you've cited the Rav a few times, so the double wow whammy. The Rav was very sensitive to these matters. The Rav said you couldn't even watch John Kennedy's funeral because there was Christian elements to it. And here to say a prayer. Now, granted, Chacham Yitzchak Yosef might say, well, I'm saying my prayer, he's saying his prayer. We're not saying the same prayer, but that's what interfaith prayer is. You're together citing prayers to the Lord. And even to sit and to be right next to the Catholic priest while he's doing his thing, it's a shocking image. And I don't know why. What was the need for this? I understand we have Corona, but why did both chief rabbis feel that it was important for them to do something like that? I'd love to know how they were convinced to do that. Rav Yitzchak Yosef, coming from the Sephardic world also, he doesn't have an appreciation of the church. They know nothing, these people, about Christianity. And for him, even to meet with the Pope was, it's like meeting with Avodah Zarah. They have a hard time doing it. They're not used to meeting with Christians. When they met with the Pope, who's a good man, this Pope, very good relationship with Jews, Rav Yitzchak Yosef wore this, he has this necklace which has the Ten Commandments on it. He wore that to show that, you know, we're not, the Pope wears his cross, so I'm going to wear the Ten Commandments. And Baruch says, the chief rabbis are state employees, not Haredim, not standard Haredim. That's not really the case anymore. Ever since Rav Yoshev came in, I would say that Rav Amar is not a Haredi. Rav Grossman, Haredi like you call it. He comes out of the Haredi world. He is Haredi. He's not the Haredi. He doesn't just mean B'nai Brak. Chevron is also Haredi. Rav Yecheskel Sarna was at the dedication of Heichal Shlomo. You say he's not Haredi? Today you have many Haredim who are Dayanim and also chief rabbis of cities. They want to take it over. That's the revolution of Revel Yoshev, that we don't, they say, we're not apart now from the apparatus. We want to conquer it and take it over. And the system they have today in appointing Dayanim is one third Haredim, one third religious Zionist, and one third Sephardic. Haredim, actually. Sephardic Haredi is not a Litvish Haredi. They're more open-minded. But it's still, that's the system, the unofficial system that they've worked out now about Dayanim. Due to their being employed by the state, they're in a different position. That was Rav Shach's position, but that's not Rav Yashin's position. Of course, the Haredim don't look to the chief rabbinate as a source for halacha guidance. No, they never had. That's why Rav Yashiv wanted to put in Rabbi Metzger. The whole point was to make him a chief rabbi, a functionary, so everyone know he's just someone to go meet the Pope and do things like that. They've never accepted the chief rabbinate. Where Rav Shechter, Shmuley says, Rav Shechter said, would maybe apply also to the Ashkenazi community of the Rhineland, since according to some, they predate the Talmud. You have these legends about that the people living in Germany come from the tribe of Binyamin, all sorts of things like that. You can even say Yemenite, the Yemenite community. I have a sefer in which the author says that they did not accept pasakum, non-Jewish bread, in Yemen. Not because he's a Yemenite, right? And it's not because of the heterim that we spoke about. It's because they precede the gezeira, and he never accepted it. I don't know if that's true, but that's what he says. But Rav Shechter holds that all groups are bound by the Talmud, and it makes sense what Rav Shechter is saying. In the days of the Talmud, you had Jews living in Spain, you had Jews living in North Africa, so they don't know what's going on in Babylonia, but then they get a letter telling them that it doesn't, when I say letter, it's not really a letter. People started emigrating. And eventually they learned that the great rabbis, and they regarded them as great rabbis, they would ask questions they would send their questions to Babylonia. Then they learned that this is the halacha. So in Spain, where the Jews have been living since Bayit Sheni, they came with the Romans, or North Africa, when people, learned rabbis, start moving there, they tell them, hey, you know, you can't do this. Why can't I do this? We've always done it. Well, because the rabbis, the great rabbis in Babylonia, or even the great rabbis in Israel, or Yisrael, have decided that this on Shabbos is not allowed. So I'm not saying the first generation accepted, but over time, eventually, that's how the Talmud spread. It's a big question. How did the Talmud spread? How did Jews living in far-flung places accept the Talmud? And were there places that did not accept it at first? David Eisen, another example of accepted halacha practice presented by Rabbi Dr. Shalom is that men and women may greet each other by kissing. Yes, in Ethiopia, that was a practice. So Rabbi Steinsaltz, this is Ahav, says, in the introduction to his book, The Talmud, says, markets were open in biblical Israel on Shabbat, money and all. Money is not subsumed under one of 39 av malachot. Well, much of what we do is rabbinic, but we can't reinvent the wheel. I gave the example of eating chicken together with milk. Are you going to say we can do that? I don't know what the Ethiopians do with that. We sort of have to accept the system. Mel says, for those who may not be familiar, Dov Lichtenstein's weekly podcast is called Headlines. I haven't heard it. I haven't been driving back and forth to work in many months, although we start at my university in August, so I like to listen to him in the car on the way to Scranton, because I find it fascinating. Here's a guy, very wealthy. He's actually a billionaire, an authentic billionaire. He's very liberal in politics. He gave $100,000 to Hillary Clinton. So he doesn't, I guess when you're that wealthy, you don't need to go with the flow of the rest of the Orthodox voting for Trump. He can make up his own mind. And he says, well, Rabbi Ganak, he calls Rabbi Ganak the what do you call him? The Mashkiach of America. And Rabbi Ganak, if you know Rabbi Ganak, he's been a Democrat from a long time ago. But David Lichtenstein has interesting guests on, and he discusses things, and it's called Headlines. He says some of his guests have been mistreated. Yes. David Berger was sort of mistreated, and I have to say, David Lichtenstein, although I enjoy his talk, he had no clue what David Berger was speaking about. He was unprepared. He didn't get it. So you can go and listen to his show when he deals with David Berger. And David Berger is flabbergasted that that Lichtenstein doesn't know what he's talking about. Basic, what Berger's talking about, basic things. You can reject Berger, but at least know what he's talking about. Instead, Lichtenstein just saying, like, how can you defame all these great Chabad people who help us in places? Oh, there was, but at other times he's much better than that. And he's a Talmud Chacham. He's published a couple interesting books. Did I read? You have a hang up on this, Baruch. Did I drink some Lubavitch Kool-Aid recently? I told you that this part of my family, step grandfather from Bobroisk. That's Chabad. That's not Lubavitch. No, I didn't drink the Kool-Aid. So Shmuel says Satmar doesn't support BDS. That is true. They don't support BDS. And I said, but what they do support is the delegitimization of the state of Israel, saying that there will not be a state of Israel. The state of Israel has to be destroyed. They say, we don't know how it's going to be, but the Rebbe said that before Mashiach comes, the state of Israel has to be destroyed. They do not give comfort to Iran, Satmar. They would support Israel in a war, but they still believe that the state of Israel is illegitimate. That in itself gives support for BDS, because Satmar says there should not be a state of Israel. Rav Henkin was opposed to the creation of a state of Israel, not for theological reasons, but he thought it would be dangerous. That it would, and Rav Aaron Kuttner was opposed to the creation of a state of Israel for theological reasons. He thought there was a problem, apparently he thought, because we see in the Marianon conference, it goes against ideas that where a Jew is supposed to remain in the Golos, almost like Satmar. But once the state was declared, now you have millions of Jews' lives at danger. Rav Aaron Kuttner becomes the biggest supporter of it. Rav Henkin becomes the biggest supporter of it. Satmar still has, unlike all the other groups, Bubov and Bells, they were all anti-Zionists before the war. But once the state is declared, they change. Satmar refused that. Rav Aaron, I asked Rav Aaron about this. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, these were his words, Bazeh HaLashon. He said, the Satmar Rebbe, he made a big blunder. That was his words. The Rebbe didn't think it's a blunder. But so that's what I mean when Satmar gives cover for BDS and Mel says they don't need Satmar anymore. They have Peter Beinart. Yes, Peter Beinart, who I'm told I've never met him, is a Shomer Mitzvos and an Orthodox Jew. Hyman says, when the OU started its monthly Mishnah pamphlets in the 80s, they would frequently quote Pesachim of Rabbi Stern. I contacted a rabbinic friend who at the time worked for the OU and cited to him several Chuvos and Ber Moshe, where Rabbi Stern goes off on the OU's kashrus, because if I recall correctly, the rabbis of Yiddish Lach are affiliated with YU and all that it implied for him. Citations to Ber Moshe ended pretty quickly thereafter. That's probably a good thing that Hyman did. If you go to Tinek, though, Tinek is like the center of this modern orthodoxy. You have a Vod there, Vod HaKashrus, all these religious Zionist rabbis in Tinek. And yet you see these people from Muncie, they come in, because apparently there's no real good restaurants in Muncie. So you see all these Hasidic types, and it amazes me when I see this, because these guys are trusting these YU Zionist rabbis in Tinek, and they're coming to eat under the Vod in Tinek. David Eisen says, Rabbi Lichtenstein, we're talking about Rav Aaron, would certainly engage opponents with the religious Zionist camp very vociferously. Immediately come to mind are a sharp exchange with Dov Lior and Yaakov Shapiro on Parash Azalia has debated against Rav Yitzchak Greenberg is legendary. But Rav Lichtenstein was speaking there about, he wasn't doing it ad hominem, number one, and he wasn't engaging because people attacked him. Rav Tendler believes in responding, if people would attack Rav Soloveitchik, for instance. As far as I know, Rav Lichtenstein never believed in that. He was dealing with substantive issues. With Rav Dov Lior, who we quoted already in the book, because they thought Rav Dov Lior's philosophy of Zionism was completely immoral, you know, the way he related to the Arabs. I don't know about his exchanges with Yaakov Shapiro. I know about his exchange with Rav Dov Lior. They even had a public debate, I think it was at Hechel Shlomo, in 1982, during the midst, or 83, during the Lebanon War, where Rav Dov Lior said that he'd rather, he didn't believe that you need to, like, in the army, to take any risks for civilians. He says, I'd rather see the Arab killed and even one hair of the Israeli soldier harmed. So as I recall, Rav Lichtenstein's response was, well, how far do you take it? Do you just drop an atom bomb then on Beirut and destroy the whole city? And of course, his debate with Yitz Greenberg is legendary. He went after David Hartman as well. But these are not ad hominem; they're not personal, and they deal with substantive issues. David Eiser, Ramsland most recently for Knesset is number 2 on the Zahut list of the Fagan's Libertarian Party. It's very difficult to place this list as on the political right or left. Once I got to know Rabbi Amsalam, he sends me these WhatsApps, and his attacks on the Haredim, and he's now rediscovered what it means to be an old-time Sephardi. But I'll give you some of his interesting ideas. Chaim says at Lander College they wore gowns. Thank you for that. Three more things here. Shmuel says the Ashkenazim went according to the Talmud, but many of their minhagim are actually according to the Yerushalmi. Rav Hamburger expands on this as Minagav Ramiza. That's true, and we think also in Italy, we think the same thing. So we have minhagim. However, halachot, as far as I know, the things that are decided halacha in the Bavli, those were all were unified. And I don't think that there remained, correct me if I'm wrong, Shmuley, I don't think through medieval times there remained any halachot which are actually recorded as forbidden in the Yerushalmi. Are there any that are in the forbidden in the Bavli and permitted in the Yerushalmi that still remained? Minhagim is one thing, or if it doesn't mention it, but actual contradictions between, are there any that the Bavli says Usser and Yerushalmi says Mutter, and they continued. Would Rabbi Ganak support the likes of Ilhan Omar or AOC? Absolutely not. Rabbi Ganak is one of the founders of, if you live in the New York area, you know NORPAC. NORPAC is an important lobbying organization. It's a PAC, it's a real PAC, unlike APAC, which is not a political action committee. It's a real PAC, it raises money. If you've ever gone NORPAC was canceled this year, but I've been a few times. We go in the spring and we meet with all the congressmen, every single congressman until last year, not this year, 2019, we would meet with every single congressman, even if they're not supporters of Israel. And we're talking, there's thousands of people there and every senator. Last year, for the first time, two congresspeople refused to meet with NORPAC. One is Talib, and one is AOC did meet, but the other was Omar. Omar would rather meet with Mitrei Karta. But Rabbi Ganak is one of the founders of this, and he always speaks there. So no, it's just he's a liberal, so he supports. You can be a liberal and still be in the Torah community. When I was growing up, it was just the reverse. All the Orthodox Jews were Democrats. You could find a few Republicans here and there, but it was hard. Today, it's almost the reverse. So you meant, would he vote for a Republican over them? I don't know what Rabbi Ganak would do. I assume he would. I can't imagine any Jewish person would be voting, any committed Jew is going to be voting for Omar. AOC is a little different. She's just like a leftist. She's not, doesn't have an anti-Israel... it's not part of her nature. She'll be anti-Israel as a leftist, but so I don't know. Yes, Mel says he had a close connection to the Clintons, not blinded to the Democratic Party. He wrote a book with Bill Clinton, and I hate to say it, he was embarrassed. You can go on video, you could see it, when Hillary Clinton, I think it was at the Democratic National Convention, she comes down, she sees Rebecca Knack, she goes over and gives him a kiss. And what can you do? He's caught with that kiss. It's on YouTube forever, but everyone can see. He didn't go to reach her to give her a kiss. He went, I guess, to shake her hand, and she went to give him a kiss. So what are you going to do? And he wrote a book with Bill Clinton. There's nothing wrong with it. We don't have to have everyone in... even Jesse Jackson once said, they asked him about these Black Republicans, Black conservatives. He said, that's okay. It doesn't bother me. He says, that way, who's ever in the White House, we're not in the outhouse. What he meant by that is, we need Torah Jews in every group. We the idea that you, if you're Orthodox, you only support one political party, it's a bad thing. Finally, the last question, comment, Baruch. Opposition to Lubavitch did not end with Rav Shach. Lubavitch is not in Yateg. Yeshivish don't participate in Lubavitch Siyum HaRambam to this day. That is, the Litvish world is split on Chabad. That's the subject for a different talk. You've seen me. I'm a fan of Chabad. It doesn't mean I agree with everything they do. If that makes me puzzle, Baruch, I don't know what to tell you. What can I say? Like when we saw the video, I hope this isn't disrespectful to the Litvish, but you saw the video I showed you of Rabbi Kahana and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe says to Rabbi Kahana, there are thousands of Jewish children in Israel who don't know Aleph Beis. Of course, they know Aleph Bet, but what he means is they don't know the first thing about Judaism. And these people don't care one bit. They all they care about is saying that Chabad doesn't sleep in the sukkah. Do they put even a tenth of the effort into, you know, dealing with all these kids growing up with no Jewish education? So say what you will about Chabad. And of course, there's mishigas and craziness in Chabad. But a little perspective here, you know, that's what they get all excited about. And since we started our trips to Europe, I've met so many wonderful, wonderful Chabad people. And okay, that's et chatai ani meskir. I confess my sins.
It's okay. No hate.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Thank